Okay, brethren, well, good afternoon. Today's message is in many ways not really a message. I am aware that the Bible is a very big book, and we do often give sermons on various topics to do with Christian living and so on. And from time to time, we even do, well, Bible studies, hopefully in-depth Bible studies, taking it slowly, stage by stage, and analyzing what we're doing. But equally, there is an important feature in our Bibles, which is just actually reading the Bible, trying to get the story flow, and covering sometimes as much territory as we can. So what I'd like to commence today is to do a sort of Bible reading with some light analysis of the book of Genesis. Now this will take, I'm sure, a number of Sabbaths, but the idea will be to take the book of Genesis and to go through it from chapter 1 right to the end. It will be, I guess, predominantly reading the Bible, its words, catching up the stories, the people, the personalities, the lessons that we can learn, but equally, without going into a in-depth Bible study of Genesis, nonetheless, as appears right and proper, we can stop here and there and add some clarification, add some expansion, do some cross-referencing, but without hopefully losing too much from just reading through the book itself. So that's the purpose. I'm not sure how far we'll get today. I'd like to think we get as far as, well, at least chapter 10, but let's see how far we get. So if we take our Bibles, it should be easy enough to find the book of Genesis. It's somewhere near the beginning. And we begin in chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now this obviously takes us quite a long way back in time. It does say in the beginning, and we might wonder exactly, well, I wonder when in the beginning was. If you speak to modern educators and scientists and astronomers, they'll tell you that the beginning, as far as they're concerned, was about 15 billion years ago, which of course is an exceedingly long time. Some will say, well, perhaps a bit younger, only 10 billion years ago, and some so far have produced 20 billion years old for the heavens and the earth. Now, we need to understand really that scientists who say that, astronomers who say that, are really basing their timing on the theory of evolution, because not only do scientists believe that that we evolved from amoeba and the slugs and little balls of primogenic soup somewhere, but also they believe that the Earth itself evolved out of gas and dust, that the stars themselves evolved out of dust particles and so on. And so, in order to allow all these things, all the stars, galaxies, nebulae, planets, and life forms to evolve, you need an awfully long time. And so, by one manner or another, they go back all the way to 10 billion, 15 billion, 20 billion years. But in fact, if God did what it says here he did, created the heavens and the earth, you don't need all that time. And it is entirely possible, and some other scientists and astronomers and so on believe that the Earth and the stars were created as recently as perhaps only 10,000 years ago. And that entirely fits in with the Bible. It entirely fits in with much of scientific knowledge. So we don't know the answer. It could be fairly recent. It could be a long time ago. We don't know for sure, but certainly whenever it took place, it was God who created the heavens and the earth. Verse 3, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, our understanding is that verse 2, the earth became formless and void after the sin of the angels, and was covered with obscure cloud, fog, smog, and darkness. And God started to separate the clouds and allow the light of the sun to gradually come through. We can tell that the sun probably existed because it does say in verse 2 that that the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Well, if there was no sun in existence at this stage, you wouldn't really have waters. It would just be one big block of frozen ice. So the fact the waters were there means that the temperature was somewhat above freezing, and so the sun must have been there radiating its light. Verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. So after perhaps thousands of years, or 10,000s of years, or millions of years, but I personally believe relatively recent times, the clouds and thick darkness started to part, the light came through, and finally you could discern between light and day. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and so the evening and the morning were the second day, day two. And now you have a nice clear expanse of air with waters under the expanse and with waters above the atmosphere. And many scientists believe there was a canopy, a water vapor canopy, which surrounded the Earth at this time, helping to screen out what could be a dangerous cosmic radiation. Verse 9. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. So now we've got the landmass has come out of the water, and the waters have separated off into the seas. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit, according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. So the evening and morning were the third day. And notice that evenings come before mornings, the way God counts his days. But now we see the vegetation, the lawns, the pastures, all the nice shrubs and herbs and so on, the fruit trees, looking very attractive now. Then verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, which of course would be the sun, and the lesser light to rule the night, which would be of course the moon. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, so the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And what appears to be the case is that the light was still rather dim prior to this particular point. You could discriminate between light and day. But now on day four, the clouds parted, and for the first time in perhaps many hundreds or thousands or whatever number of years, at last you could see the sun shining there in its brilliance. You could see the moon of a nighttime, and you could see the stars twinkling way off in the distance. And this was the first time for a long time since the earth had become pretty much destroyed by Satan and his angels. Then God said, verse 20, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures, and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded, according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And of course, we read over this pretty rapidly, but if we can imagine what God was doing here, you know, the earth had been empty, barren, virtually destroyed, and here by day five, we have the landmass, we have the oceans and seas, we have the pure fresh air, we have the sun shining brightly through the daytime and the stars and moon of the nighttime. We have vegetation, forests, orchards, pasture lands, and now we have in the oceans dolphins and porpoises and whales and all manner of fish. We have birds, you know, parrots and albatross, eagles and so on, all flying around. So after just a matter of a few days, the earth is now looking a gorgeous place, absolutely fantastic. Then we get to verse 24. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good." So now the land animals appear, the wolves, the lions, the bears, the giraffes, the hedgehogs, the rabbits, the mice. All these creatures now have appeared. Each, it says, according to its kind. And that would be similar perhaps to what we would class as a species, but not quite identical. But animals basically breed according to their kind. You don't get cats breeding with dogs. They can't do it. You can't get certain animals to breed with others. Animals can only really breed and multiply each according to its kind. Dogs with dogs. Cats with cats. You can get a tiger. You can cross with a lion. Then you get a liger or a tigon or something. And you can get any particular beast to breed with its particular kind, but you can't get other species to breed together. You can't get a cat and a horse. It doesn't work that way. Each according to its kind. And in a sense, of course, evolution tries to say that animals can sort of migrate across from one sort to another, that fish can become philosophers. It doesn't happen that way. The way God has constructed animals is that animals breed within their kinds. You can get a wide variety within a kind. I mean, dogs. You get little tiny chihuahuas. You get big Irish wolfhounds. You get sharp eyes. You get little Scottish terriers. They're all very different looking, different in size. Some are quite peaceful little dogs that will lie at your sort of on your lap. Others are big ferocious beasts that will bite your leg off. But they're all basically dogs. And they can actually breed. It might be a bit difficult for a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, but it is possible that they can breed because they are all of the one kind. Verse 26, after God has made all of these animals, birds, and fish, and whales, and so on, now the story changes somewhat. In verse 26, one of the perhaps key passages in the whole Bible, because remember, we're only in chapter 1 of Genesis, and now look what is said here. Then God said, "Let us, that's more than one person, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." So God said, well, we've made all these animals, we've made lions, and we've made hedgehogs, and we've made all these various creatures, we've made beautiful fish in the sea, we've made the octopus and the sea squid and all that sort of stuff, but now let us make man. And what will he look like? Well, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Likeness means to have the appearance. You know, man was going to be created to have the appearance of God. And so, if we know what we look like, we can have a good idea what God looks like, because God made us to have the same appearance as he has. Two eyes, two ears, a nose, a mouth, hands, feet, hair. That's what God looks like, because it says here, let us make man in our image, that really means character, according to our likeness, our appearance. Let them have dominion, so man is going to have a special position here. Let them have dominion, right? That means in a sense a rule, or to govern, or to be over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So man was made, in a sense, to rule from the very beginning. Man is made to look like God. He was made to have God's character ultimately, and he was made here to be the ruler, the dominant one upon the earth. There's a scripture in, we won't turn there perhaps, but you can mark your notes in Psalms 115, verse 16, which says, the heaven, even the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth he has given to the children of men. And that's exactly what it says here in verse 26. You know, the heavens belong to God, but the earth he's created for mankind, made it fit and suitable for human life to exist, made Adam, and then presented the earth to him, and gave man dominion over all the creatures upon this earth. Verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So man was commanded there to be fruitful, to multiply, to have families, to fill the earth, and to keep it really under control, to be, if you like, the master of the earth. But of course, the way that God would see that is that you'd be looking after the earth almost as a husbandman. You'd be caring for the earth, you'd be adding value to the earth, you'd be conserving. What man's done through the generations, through the centuries, is largely to exploit the earth, to destroy it, to quarry it and leave great scars in the landscape. If we think of the Sahara Desert today, the Sahara Desert is just hundreds of thousands of square miles of just sand. Sand dunes, scorching winds blowing over it, totally inhospitable. If you landed today, if you sort of bailed out of an aeroplane and landed in the Sahara Desert, you would last perhaps one day, and that's the end of you. And yet, we know in the days of the Roman Empire, the Sahara Desert was actually a tremendous place where there were all sorts of animals and vegetation and lakes and orchards, and they used to go there to what is North Africa, where the Sahara Desert now is, and bring back tens of thousands of chimpanzees, other types of apes, lions and so on. At that time, North Africa was a very bountiful, beautiful place. But you know, the Romans and others destroyed it. And large parts of the earth today have been almost poisoned by mankind. Even today, in parts of South America, they're busy chopping down forests and burning them as fast as they can, utilizing the wood, destroying and making a horrendous picture of a very beautiful part of the earth. And that was not, of course, God's intention. He meant mankind to oversee and to protect and add to and beautify the earth. Carrying on verse 29, and God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So it didn't take God very long, did it, really? 6 days later, the earth is now fully populated. All types of animals and creatures and insects and butterflies and birds and fish, ocean creatures, and even mankind. And all of that done in just 6 days. That's fast work. It could have taken God longer, of course, I guess, if he wanted to slow down a wee bit. Or perhaps he could have done it in just a couple of 3 days if he put his toe down. But it took 6 days for a reason. That was because you require 6 days in order to have something special happen on the seventh day. And already God was thinking about the Sabbath day. It was part of his plan from a long time ago. And if you want the seventh day to be a special day, a day of rest, and something you're going to use as part of your planning for centuries and millennia to come, then you need to do something for 6 days in order to create a special day on the seventh day. And that's what God was actually doing. Chapter 2, verse 1. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. And so that's, of course, the origins of the Sabbath day, right? The very, very beginning part of the Bible. You know, there's a lot of individuals who think that Genesis chapters 1 to 11 are all just a Jewish fairy tale, myth. Perhaps Moses might have wrote them, but they were just stories put together, you know, by well-meaning people to try and explain the world, the earth. But actually, chapters 1 to 11 are filled with information which you cannot get elsewhere. And a good understanding of chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis actually gives us a real basis to make sense of the world we live in today. It's far from being fairy tale and myth and just religious writings. You know, these are key passages of the Bible. They're also, of course, very brief. If you think about it, chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis span virtually 2,000 years of man's history. You know, we're probably 6,000 years since these days in the Garden of Eden and so on. But 11 chapters is all you get for the first 2,000 years. And then Jesus came, of course, 4,000 years after the days of Adam. But the whole Bible then, from Genesis chapter 12 almost to the end of it, deals with, you know, you've got all that Bible for thousands of years and 11 chapters for only 2,000 years. It's very brief. It doesn't tell us a great deal, but it tells us enough. So here we see the origins and the creation of the Sabbath day, which God made by resting from his work. For 6 days he worked, and on the seventh day he rested from all the work he'd done, relaxed, looked around, took the time to enjoy his creation. And then we move on to verse 4, which begins, in a sense, another explanation. This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the eternal God made the earth and the heavens, before any plant of the field was in the earth, and before any herb of the field had grown. For the eternal God had not caused it to rain on the earth, and there was no man to till the ground. So no rain as yet. But it says, verse 6, a mist went up from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. Now, we don't know a great deal about the earth at this time, but it does seem to be the case that perhaps rain had not yet arrived. And of course, most of us in the British Isles are very familiar with rain. But at this time, it was more of a mist that sort of went up continually and then sort of fell back down as a gentle, beautiful moistness that kept everything just fresh and very pleasant. And the mist, if it was related to this water canopy people talk about, probably helped to protect the earth and mankind from from solar radiation. We know the sun's rays are so strong that in outer space, people like astronauts and so on have to be very careful not to be damaged, you know, by the rays from the sun. X-rays and other radiation can be very harmful. And of course, you know, some people, particularly like in Australia, do reckon that the sun's strength is so powerful that many people there associate skin cancers and so on with the sun's radiation. But it seems back in these days that the earth had a very different climate, and this mist and the water vapor canopy, if it existed, was partly there to protect and keep the earth nice and safe. And the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground. Dust just means dirt. And breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being, or as the King James would say, a living soul. And of course, when you talk about souls and living souls, people get all mixed up. Oh, a soul, that's something, some sort of spiritual thing that's inside of you. I think I've mentioned before that when I was a young Catholic boy and we were being taught about the soul, Of course, it was always referred to as the immortal soul when I was at school. I couldn't quite visualize what an immortal soul would look like, but to me it was my mind's eye, sort of rather blurred picture, but I could somewhat see this like a balloon, sort of not a circular balloon, one of these long thin balloons sort of inside your chest somewhere, which would sort of a dull glow, but when you sinned, black marks would appear on it. And if you had a mortal sin, which meant missing church on Sundays as a Catholic, it turned completely black. And if you went to confession and confessed all your sins, and the priest gave you absolution, then suddenly that's a balloon would turn from some old black marks or totally black to glowing again. And to me, that was the soul, this strange balloon object somewhere in your chest, which was pretty stupid, really, thinking about it. But that made sense to me as a 10, 12-year-old. But here it says that God took the dirt, the earth, the ground, formed and shaped it with legs and arms and fingers and so on, and then breathed into it, and this material dust became a living being. And that's how, you know, Adam happened. The eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. So he creates Adam and put him into this beautiful garden. And we can only imagine, you know, what sort of garden, you know, God would have designed and created. I mean, when people today talk about the fancy gardens of the likes of Charlie Dimmock and somebody might produce for a BBC TV program or something. But here we're talking about the designer, the capital D, the creator with a capital C, the greatest architect there has ever been, you know, God himself, in the person here of course, Jesus Christ. And I'm sure that when Jesus designed and created this garden, it would have been a spectacular garden. And that's where he put Adam. Verse 9, and out of the ground the eternal God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So lots of trees, possibly hundreds of them, all shapes and sizes, big leaves and little leaves, dark green, perhaps copper beeches, all sorts of different barks and so on. But in among all these trees and the orchards and so on, two special trees, which we know, of course, a great deal about. Verse 10. Now a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it parted and became four river heads. The name of the first is Pishon. It is the one which encompasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Of course, many people say gold is good, full stop. Delium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It is the one which encompasses the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Hiddekel. It is the one which goes toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Well, that's only one I think we know of today. There still is a river today with the name of the Euphrates over there in Iraq, not far from Baghdad. Then the eternal God took the man, that's Adam, and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. My margin says to cultivate. And really that's what God's looking for. You know, Adam had a job to do. He wasn't just going to sit there in a deck chair and just stare around at the trees and watch the animals romping about and just have another glass of lager and lime and just take things easy. You know, it wasn't supposed to be too desperately hard for him, but he got some work to do. He was to look after the garden and maintain it, to keep it neat and tidy, probably add a bit to it, add his own little personal touches to beautify it, and perhaps do some things that would give God some pleasure. And eternal God commanded the man, saying, of every tree in the garden you may freely eat, no charge. You want that tree over there, or the fruit of that tree? Fine. Adam, pick and choose anything you want. The whole garden, the orchards, they're there just for you to enjoy. Feel free. But there is one tree, Adam, which is not available to you. Of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Or the Hebrew would say, dying you shall die. Because it wasn't the case that if you ate the fruit that you would drop dead on the spot. that really wouldn't help very much at all. God's plan would have a rather abrupt ending if that was the case. But what it means is that if you were to disobey me, Adam, and you were to eat the fruit of that particular tree, you would begin a process in your physical body that doesn't currently occur. At the moment, Adam, your body will just keep on living. It will keep on regenerating and renewing. But if you were to eat the fruit of that particular tree, a process will begin, and dying, you will ultimately die. And that was a good warning, I think, to Adam. And we have to assume that Adam understood what dying meant. As we said earlier, the passages in Genesis 1 to 11 are very brief, but God could hardly say, Adam, you will die, and wander off. And Adam thinks, I wonder what dying is. I wonder what that means, dying? What's dying? It might be a good thing for all Adam knew. So therefore we can, I think, take it that God explained enough for Adam to have a pretty good understanding about the fact he had a choice, and that he knew the penalty of the wrong choice. And the everlasting God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper comparable to him. Because up till this time, you know, Adam could shout to the wolves to come across and give them a quick scratch behind the ears and perhaps throw a piece of fruit for them to race after. He could have perhaps hopped in the back of a big stallion and gone galloping about through the fields and pastures and around the Garden of Eden and so on. Adam could perhaps have called the birds and they'd come and perch on his fingers and whistle and sing in his ears. And it was good fun. I'm sure Adam really enjoyed it. But ultimately Adam would have looked around and thought, you know, there's nobody here quite like me. I mean, I can talk. And I can dream, and I can imagine, and I can even do things and sort of help to tidy and beautify and even create in the Garden of Eden here certain pictures and beauty and so on. But none of these animals are quite like me. And so, you know, God knew that. And he knew that it's not particularly good for a man to be alone. And so he would make a helper meet or comparable or suitable or fitted to Adam. Out of the ground, the eternal God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. So, you know, little by little, they went through all these animals and birds. And Adam said, well, I'll call that one a parrot. I'm going to call that one a hedgehog. That one's going to be called a snail. That one's going to be called a rabbit. That one there, I think I'll call that one a sloth. But hang on, there's nobody just like me. And verse 21, the eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam. So God anesthetized him, put him under, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs, this is the first operation that we are aware of, and then closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the eternal God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. So once Adam woke up, lo and behold, there's this gorgeous dolly bird right in front of him. Not a giraffe this time, not a hippopotamus, but a gorgeous woman. What was she like? I would imagine she was a stunner, as we would say today. Whether she was blonde or brunette or redhead, no idea. But certainly, if Jesus Christ had fashioned her, I'm sure she was really quite striking. And she was brought to Adam, and I guess his eyeballs popped when he saw this female in front of him, particularly since she wasn't clothed at the time. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones. So obviously he knew what God had done, and flesh of my flesh, because literally she was created, built upon Adam's own, you know, bone structure and so on, and flesh of my flesh. She should be called a woman because she was taken out of man. So woman, because she was taken out of man, or the Hebrews are plain words there as well, ish and ishi. Verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And God actually said those words because Jesus quoted this verse back in Matthew 19 and said that God said, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. It wasn't just Moses writing these words. It wasn't Adam recording it afterwards. This was actually what God said. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. I think we've always said it's not a good idea when a couple first get married that they hang around and live with their parents. Sometimes because of economic reasons, people think, well, we can't afford our own house. So what we'll do is for the first couple of years till we get on our feet, we'll live at home. Well, I suppose it can work. It depends just how tolerant and laid back the parents and so on are. But as a general rule, it says here that you're better to leave your parents and cleave to each other. You form a new union, a new family. And you keep in touch, obviously, with your parents as far as you can. But really, you've got a different path to tread now. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. There was no shame or feeling of guilt by the fact they were naked. There was nothing like a sex sin at this time. That came a little bit later, once Satan had got involved. And so on to chapter 3. Now the serpent was more cunning, more devious, than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? So the devil decides that rather than tackling Adam, he'll go after the woman. And I guess he saw the woman as being the more easy to pull the wool over her eyes, a bit more vulnerable to his glib talk. And so he approached Eve first and foremost. And then put this rather, this question's got a seed in it of doubt. Has God really said that you're not to eat of every tree? Mm-hmm. And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Well, actually, we've got no record that God said you weren't to touch it. That may be something that Eve added to the story, just being not quite accurate with the record. But nonetheless, she knew that, well, that particular tree there, yep, you're right, we are not to eat it. And the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. You are, in fact, you might phrase it this way, you are an immortal soul. You can't die, Eve. Don't you know that? Well, you're an immortal soul. You're really a spirit in that body. You'll just keep on. You won't die. That's this. Well, God's pulling a fast one on you. That's not true. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Eve, that tree, well, there's a reason that God's keeping that tree away from you. He knows that tree will give you secret insight. That tree will give you special revealed knowledge. God's keeping you away from that tree because it suits his good purpose. Oh, Eve, you will not surely die. You're an immortal soul. So, when the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, it certainly was an attractive looking tree apparently, and a tree, oh, desirable to make one wise. Suddenly she's got visions here of being, oh, I could be smart as God. I'm going to understand great secrets. Oh, here is the key to the mysteries which I need to know about. She took of its fruit and ate. So she had a choice. There was a tree, and she was told by God and by Adam not to eat of it, because in the day you eat of that tree, dying, you will surely die. But here comes the serpent and says, oh, no, eat that tree and you'll gain incredible understanding and revealed knowledge. She had a choice. Choose the tree of life, which was still there, of course, or choose the other tree. And what did she do? She chose the other tree. She listened to Satan, the devil, and she rejected God's truth. She also gave to her husband with her, and Adam also ate of that tree as well. We could say pretty foolish. We can look back and think, weren't they a pair of prime idiots? You know, the Garden of Eden, the whole world in front of them, God walking in the cool of the evening with them and talking to them, and they are so stupid as to eat of that tree. I mean, what was in these people's minds? But then, of course, we realize that today we have choices, sometimes rather plain choices, and how often do we make the wrong choice in the full knowledge that we're making the wrong choice? So we can hardly blame Adam and Eve, because in many ways we've been as pretty stupid ourselves with what we know as they were with what they knew. Of course, this particular tree, sometimes people see it's an apple tree. You know, you've got, after all, your larynx, so-called Adam's apple, as it's sometimes called, and there's no real indication it was an apple tree. That appears to be it's come from the Latin version. In Latin, the word for apple is malam, and the word for evil is malum. So in Latin, the word for evil and apple sound virtually the same. So the tree of evil, knowledge of evil, and tree of an apple are very similar in the Latin language. And of course, for many centuries, Bibles were only available in this country in Latin. So it'd be quite easy for people to misconstrue a tree of evil with being an apple tree. But as far as we're aware, apples are still fine to eat. Then verse 7. Then, having eaten this fruit, whatever it was, the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. Suddenly, after Satan has introduced them to this tree, suddenly they feel guilty. Suddenly they feel ashamed. You know, God made them and designed them. They were both beautiful. They were on their own, living in a fantastic garden. But suddenly now they look at each other and they've got something to hide. Their mind has changed instantaneously. It says, verse 7, the eyes of both of them were opened. Well, their eyes were open anyway, because you couldn't have plucked the fruit without seeing the fruit on the tree. You could have seen all the animals and birds without your eyes being open. But what it means is that suddenly their understanding changed. Suddenly they saw things they didn't see before. Suddenly their mind had been regrettably perverted and twisted because of the responding to Satan and taking of this particular tree. And now suddenly evil starts to filter into their minds. Verse 8, and they heard the sound of the eternal God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the everlasting God among the trees of the garden. Some people accuse God of hiding from mankind, but the first illustration we find is it's mankind hiding from God. Then the eternal God called to Adam and said to him, Where are you, Adam? Adam? Adam, where are you? So he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. So you can see the change here. Listening to Satan, Adam's mind has become very quickly much more twisted than it was before. Here we see that fear enters the human race. I was afraid. That's the first time that mankind uttered the words fear and being afraid. As a result of listening to Satan the devil, suddenly fear is there. No longer the warmth, no longer the love for this great being who had walked and talked with Adam, no longer the great respect. Now suddenly Adam's hiding from God. Now he's afraid of his creator. And God said, verse 11, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? Well, I mean, obviously God knew the answer, but he's presenting the question, and let's see where it goes from here. Then the man said, ah, and here we come, the first scapegoat. You know, a lot of firsts here, but suddenly the first time somebody blames somebody else appears in the scene. Then the man said, well, the woman whom you gave me to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. So really, it was her fault, or if it wasn't her fault, it was your fault, God. I mean, not my fault. I mean, you can hardly blame me, but that woman. I mean, look what she's done to me. And anyway, you gave me, you know, you created her. You gave her to me. If you hadn't done that, just been the rhinoceroses and the hedgehogs, that, I mean, all right, it's really your fault, God. And the everlasting God said to the woman, what is this you have done? And the woman said, well, it was somebody else. The serpent deceived me, and I ate. So really, it was his fault. And it's common human nature for us all to find everybody else is at fault apart from us. But we all know that each one of us is, you know, nigh on perfect. And we might occasionally make a tiny mishap, inadvertently and unconsciously, but it's always the fault of the husband or the wife or the kids or the minister or the prime minister, or it's always somebody's fault, isn't it? Never us. We're all as innocent and as good-natured as can be. And it's been that way since the Garden of Eden. So the everlasting God said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are cursed more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And this is the first prophecy, in a sense, about the seed of the woman, which was to be, of course, ultimately Jesus Christ. He would bruise Satan's head and really stamp on Satan and cause major damage to Satan's plans. But at the same time, it says, you, Satan, will bruise his heel. And, of course, Satan stirred up mankind ultimately to crucify Jesus Christ. So that first enmity and the prophecy of Jesus being bruised, right here in the third chapter of Genesis. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain, or the Hebrew can mean in toil, you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And the word pain there is quite clear, of course, that child bearing is not exactly the most pleasant experience, so I'm told. Of course, as a man, I've not actually experienced it directly. But I've been fairly close to it, having said that, and it looked pretty hard work to me. But the word in Hebrew really means more, it will be toil and hard work to bring forth children, which it is. Then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife, you know, rather than heeding my word, and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, right? Because you turned away from me, you rejected the word of God, you listened to the voice of your wife, something men have been prone to do ever since, particularly when the wife's voice can be sometimes rather persistent. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil, same word as childbearing, in toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So, just warning Adam that life's going to be a bit harder from now on for you, Adam. The ground is going to be very much hostile to you. You have to work pretty hard with weeds and thistles and briars and all sorts of struggles and trouble from now on. You want to do it your way? Well, I guess that's fine, but you're going to find it a hard job, mate. It'll be pretty tough from now on. And by the way, let me remind you again that I said earlier, dying you shall die. Well, you came out of the ground, Adam. I formed you from the dust and the dirt, and one day you'll return to it. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Simple as that. And Adam called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. Also for Adam and his wife, the eternal God made tunics of skin and clothed them. So I guess that was the first, in a sense, animal sacrifice. Animals were killed so that God could make some skins and adorn. The Hebrew word for clothe there means to adorn. It wasn't just covering up something nasty such as nakedness. It was actually designed to be a rather attractive ornamentation on Adam and Eve. Then the eternal God said, behold, the man has now become like one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put out his hand and take also the tree of life and eat and live forever. And then it stops at that point because, ooh, that would be pretty horrendous if we allow Adam and Eve to go and take that other tree. Because remember, they were still in the Garden of Eden. All the trees were there, including the tree of life. And they could have gone and reached it. So God said, nope, I've got to put them away before they reach that tree, because if they reach that tree, and take of that fruit and live continually, knowing what they know and getting into the trouble that they are going to get into, that's not really very kind of me, and it'll be a major problem, and the pain and suffering and anguish that will follow will be immense. Nope, can't allow that to happen. 23, therefore, the Eternal God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. So he drove out the man, not in a motor car, but probably at the end of a spear or something. He drove out the man, and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So these angels, these angelic creatures, were set there with a flaming sword to guard and protect and make sure that neither Adam nor Eve nor any of their children could get back to the tree of life. And it does seem that, well, I guess those were there right until the time of the flood, which was nearly 2,000 years later. So there was plenty of opportunity for many, many millions of people to know where the Garden of Eden was, to have come and visited it from a distance, but nobody could get near the tree of life. And they would have seen these cherubim, apparently, and this flaming sword there, and they would have known that, look, there's a tree there which has got something of tremendous value on it, something that is a great treasure, something that can, will be the, it'll give you, it's the elixir of life, if we could just get to it. But these creatures guard it, these dragons protect it, we can't get near it. And of course that gave birth to many of the fairy tales and the myths from the Greek and Roman world and so on. Jason and these tree with the golden fleece, which is, you know, tremendous treasure on this tree, but you can't get to the tree because of the dragons that surround it and all the strange creatures and the adventures of those who tried to get to it. Most of that is built upon this particular episode here. Carrying on in chapter 4. Now Adam knew his wife, that means that intimately, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have gotten a man from the everlasting. And this would be the first child born then, Cain, the first human being to be born, of, shall we say, naturally. Then she bore again. It's interesting, it doesn't say that Adam knew his wife a second time and she conceived. It says that he knew his wife and she bore Cain and she bore again. So without there being a further conception, it's quite likely this is talking of a twin, that Abel was Cain's twin. So she bore once, Cain, and she bore pretty much immediately again, and this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Eternal. Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat. And the Eternal respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So many years had passed now, not too sure of what the age of Cain and Abel was, could be 20, could be 25, could be 30, could be 50, who knows. But certainly these men were now grown adults, and they know about God, of course. They've been taught by Adam and Eve a fair amount of the creation, and about the serpent, no doubt, and all of that stuff. And so they knew that they should be worshipping the Creator God, and Cain brings his particular sacrifice, and Abel brings his. And it seems very likely that Cain, from what we know, brought his with a rather bad attitude, perhaps a rather begrudging, why have I got to do this, whinge, this being, look what he's done anyway, he's thrown us out of that beautiful garden when we can't go back. And so Cain brought his in a rather foul attitude, whereas Abel brought his, apparently, in a sort of sense of respect for God and gratitude for the creation and the many blessings he had got. And so that's why God accepted the one and not the other. It was to do with the attitude, and for you and I it's the same. We can go to God in a good attitude and he'll respect us, or we can go in a bad attitude and he won't be quite as happy with us. So the Eternal said to Cain, verse 6, why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? In other words, if you're doing things right, Cain, there's no problem. It's straightforward. And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. You know, here's one of the early references to sin. That sin was camped, if you like, at Cain's door. But God says, look, Cain, you need to overcome this pool of sin. It's right camped outside your tent door. And you're rather vulnerable, but you should endeavor to rise above it and resist it. Now, Cain talked with Abel, his brother. We can imagine the conversation. And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And this really, you've got to think, this is unbelievable in a sense. The whole world is waiting. It's got a huge opportunity. You know, today we live often in towns and cities, and there's millions of people living all clustered together. And if you want to buy land to build a house on, you've got all the difficulties with building regulations and planning regulations and permission of the local authority and boundaries and whatnot. You know, here are, you know, Cain and Abel, and the whole world is their proverbial oyster. And instead of enjoying the whole earth and the freedom that they had, and taxation wouldn't be a particular problem in those days, or national insurance contributions or whatever, but here what happens is the first murder. You know, we're in the early days of man's history, in a beautiful world still, and Cain slays his own brother, who might in fact be his own twin brother. Absolutely incredible. Then the Eternal said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And of course God knew where he was, but nonetheless God likes to deal with us and ask us to commit ourselves and say what's in our hearts and so on. And he said, well, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I supposed to be looking after my brother or something? What a ridiculous question. So you can see, you know, Cain's attitude coming through all the time, can't you? The guy was really rather a nasty sort. And God said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So God knew well and truly what had happened. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. Remember, he was a tiller of the land. He'd been able to perhaps exploit the land and use it wisely. God said, sorry, mate. From now on, the ground is cursed, as far as you're concerned. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. And Cain said to the Eternal, my punishment is greater than I can bear. It wasn't that Cain was in any way repentant for killing his brother. There's no trace of that, but Cain was certainly a bit sorry to hear of his punishment. You know, he was a bully perhaps, and he wasn't going to be remorseful. No intention of apologizing to God and seeking, you know, God's forgiveness. It was just a question, didn't like the punishment. You know, that's a bit too severe, I don't like that. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth, and it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. You know, because I've killed, you know, Abel. And the Eternal said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Eternal set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Eternal, and dwelt in the land of Nod, on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And then people say, well, where did Cain get his wife from? There's only Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. But as we said earlier, Cain and Abel were probably adults, could have been 25, 35, 50, 60 years old. And Adam and Eve didn't just stop with Cain and Abel. They had many more sons and daughters. We don't know exact numbers, but Jewish tradition says that they had 60 altogether, sons and daughters between them. I lived a long time, don't forget, so, you know, there was no hurry. But apparently Adam and Eve had 33 sons and 27 daughters. And of course, they had to marry each other in those days. There was nothing wrong with it in the early stages of the earth's development. Brothers and sisters were free to marry and have children, and they could marry each other and so on and so forth. So by the time Enoch got married, which might have been at the age of 100 or 120 or 150, we don't know, by that time there were many hundreds and hundreds of brothers and sisters and so on and so forth all around that part of the earth. So he knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begot Mehujael, and Mehujael begot Methushael, and Methushael begot Lamech. So you can see that families are now starting to multiply, and the whole world starts to take on a new look, to the point where now even a city is built. Now, I don't know how big a city that would be. A city might have been, in those days, just a few hundred people, perhaps. Not too sure. Verse 19. Then Lamech took for himself two wives. Oh, right, okay. So now we've got from one wife, as God designed things, to Lamech being a, well, I guess you can say, well, Lamech is a descendant of Cain. Cain was a bit of a rebel, a nasty piece of work, a murderer, a liar, a rebel against God. No great surprise if his descendants aren't perhaps some of the greatest people on the earth either. So Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the second was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute. So we can tell so now that music has entered the scene. Here we are in chapter 4 of Genesis, and harps and flutes, or pipes, and no doubt many other types of musical instrument, are now appearing in the scene, which probably means bands, I guess, and orchestras after a fashion, and singing and dancing and so on. Again, Genesis is very brief, but here we can see civilization starting to develop. One can only imagine what sort of music Lamech and his descendants would have made. I suspect not altogether too good. And as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. So now they're melting metals and forming alloys, and no doubt making nice things like swords, spears, and axes to behead people, and so on. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Then Lamech said to his wives, both of them, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. And this perhaps was a song he may have written with the music that was being produced by his other descendants. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain should be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. So they knew the stories of Cain. They knew what God said to him. But here is Lamech has also murdered somebody or killed somebody, even a young man. Hey, I'm Lamech, the conqueror. See, even young men that try to wound me, I've taken care of him all right. I've beat his brains out. And so he's proud and singing songs of his prowess as a killer. The martial arts hero of Genesis chapter 4. And anyway, so we leave the story at that point and move back to Adam and Eve. And as the heading of this passage says in my Bible, the godly line of Seth. So we move now from Cain and Abel to Seth. Verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Eternal. So another line begins here. This is the line of Seth, which leads all the way down, of course, ultimately to Jesus Christ. Chapter 5. Reading time-wise. One more chapter, I'm told. Didn't get as far as I thought I was going to get. Anyway, chapter 5. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. And there are several chapters which commence with this is the book of the genealogy of somebody or other. So it may have been actually kept by the likes of Adam and others as histories at the time, which Moses may have had access to, and has incorporated these in the book of Genesis. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He looks like God. He created them male and female, and blessed them, and called them mankind in the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and begot a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. And we can imagine that in that 130 years, there probably were a few others who were born, but we're talking here about the line of Seth. That's what we're singling out now, because that's where the story starts to get a bit more interesting. And so the genealogy is the genealogy, if you like, of Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters, possibly as many as 60, and the Jews may have got it wrong, perhaps he begot 100, we don't know for sure. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. But God had told him, in the day you eat of this fruit, dying you shall surely die. And so it took a long time, but eventually Adam died at the age of 930, and lived to see the world develop around him to the tune of probably hundreds of millions of others. People multiplied very rapidly in those days. If you had 60 kids in your family and you lived 900 years odd, then of course families could grow and multiply all rather rapidly. Seth lived 105 years and begat Enosh. After he begot Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. I mean, can you imagine living to be 900 years old as a physical human being? I mean, today people of 70 and 80 and 90, at 90 are pretty old and doddery most of the time. But here's like living 900. I mean, people who live to be 900 or 1,000, that means that if you're alive today, you've been born in the days of the Norman Conquest, you know, 1066 and all that. You've lived all the way through the Tudors and incredible Stuarts and so on. I mean, to live 1,000 years nearly is just unbelievable to us. But it was rather common in these days. Verse 9, Enosh lived 90 years and begot Canaan. After he begot Canaan, Enosh lived 815 years and begot, oodles more sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years and he died. Canaan lived 70 years and begot Mahalalel, or something similar. After he begot Mahalalel, Canaan lived 840 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Canaan were 910 years and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years and begot Jared. After he begot Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years and he died. Jared lived 162 years and begot Enoch. And Enoch was an interesting person, though again we don't know an awful lot about him. After he begot Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years. That's a long time, 962 years. Just, less than 40 years off of 1,000. And he begot Methuselah. And he died, Enoch lived 65 years, and he begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years, and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Now that's unusual, isn't it? Because everybody else so far has been 800 or 900. And here's Enoch, and it says that he walked with God. Didn't say that about the others, but Enoch seemed to be a rather special individual. Enoch got close to God, learned God's ways, and walked with God. So he was very much different to the... he was standing out like a sore thumb, really. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Really, that's quite young. I mean, for those days. And Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. You know, God removed Enoch because of the dangers of being a man after God's own heart in a society where really that wouldn't go down too well. And it would appear that Enoch's life was often in danger because of the situation he was in. So after only a mere 365 years, God took him. Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech. After he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years and he died. 969 years. As far as we're aware, that's the oldest one of the lot. Methuselah, you often think of Methuselah being pretty old, with a long beard down to his ankles and so on. He might have been clean shaven for all we know. But he lived almost 1,000 years, an incredible length of time. He lived 969 years and he died. Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son, and he called his name Noah, saying, This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Eternal has cursed. After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So here we are now down to the end of chapter 5. And we have a population, according to my inspired marginal notes, I'm not quite sure where I got this, but some people have worked out, knowing how long people lived and making some assumptions about the size of the families, I'm not too sure how many people died of ill health or violence and so on, but there is somebody's worked out that round about when Noah was born, that the population of the earth was perhaps about 170, 180 million. So really quite a fair number, and that's when Noah was born. That's not at the flood. At the flood, the population could have been up to nearly 1 billion people, according to some calculations. So even the days of Methuselah and Lamech, you're talking of a population of over 100 million, perhaps nearly 200 million people. So the earth was a very busy place. Lots of people, lots of activity, lots of work, lots of things of that nature. So a very busy earth. And one of the things which is, in a sense, fairly surprising is just how little time there was between Adam and Noah. You know, Adam and Noah are only one generation apart, if you think about it, because Adam lived to be nearly 1,000 years old, and Methuselah and Adam coexisted for about, I think, the best part of nearly 400 or 500 years, and Methuselah and Noah coexisted for a few hundred years, so that really it was very easy for information about the Garden of Eden and all those things to pass down to the likes of Noah, because he was only really one generation removed from Adam. They have such hugely long lives. Okay, well, I think I guess we're not going to get much further today. It's a pity, because chapters 6 through 9 about the flood are pretty interesting chapters. So we'll leave it to carry on that story another time. And we'll begin the next time in chapter 6 with Noah and the incredible story of Noah's flood.